Welcome, everybody. Thanks for joining. I'm Bruce Fenton. We're here with our special guest, Jameson Lopp, who is a longtime Bitcoin. I think the best title that I can think of for Jameson is Cypherpunk. That's the one of the most honorable and best terms that I can think of. And
Hey,
so
welcome everybody.
thanks for joining, Jameson.
Well, it's always good to be called a cypherpunk rather than a self-proclaimed cypherpunk, so thank you.
Well, thanks for joining. So we're going to talk a little bit about security, OPSEC, some of the things you're known for. Those of you who don't know Jameson, he's been in the space for a long time. When did you start? 2011, 12, something like that?
Yeah, that was when I got enthusiastic, and then I really went full time and started working in the space in 2015. So it's been a good 5 years of full time Bitcoining for me.
Nice. And Jameson is joining us from a solar powered train on the border of Cash. Oh, I'm not supposed to say where that is, right? Tell us a little bit about OPSEC and what you're that's one of the things you originally interested in OPSEC, and what are your thoughts on that topic?
Well, like most people, I didn't really care about privacy until it became directly impactful to my life. It's actually kind of embarrassing because in my pre-Bitcoin days, I was really doing the antithesis of what I profess, which is I was working as a large-scale data analysis report writer essentially for online marketing companies. And I was, collating and aggregating and slicing and dicing petabytes of data on a regular basis and building tools for automation so that essentially marketers could better target people based on, any attribute that they wanted. And so perhaps that has really helped me understand how much data is out there, how hard it is to control your data, and what can happen once it gets leaked into any number of databases. And so it wasn't until around 2017 or so, of course, when that all came to a head and my poor privacy and poor operational security resulted in an unfortunate incident with law enforcement, which thankfully ended fairly about as well as it could have. And that kind of sparked my real interest at exploring the cutting edge of what you can do with privacy. Are we
Sorry,
lagging?
our connection is lagging. Sorry about that.
No problem.
What are your thoughts on some of the interesting thing about this privacy issue is that a lot of people are giving a lot of privacy away now, and there's convenience for it. Both you and I used, you're a huge user of Twitter. I don't know about you, but I use TikTok, which is one of the greatest sins now. I mean, it's blatantly spying on you, but it's also a great tool. What's your thought on that trade-off for so many people now?
Yeah, it's tricky for me because I still want to maintain a public presence. And, this has actually upset, I think, a lot of people, especially the super hardcore privacy folks who, in many cases, will say, oh, this guy's not legit. Look how public he's being about what he's doing. True operational security means not telling anybody what you're doing. And there is definitely some validity to that. But I believe that that mindset kind of contributes to the problem in the sense that when I wanted to improve my privacy, it was really hard. I had to do a lot of research. There was not a lot of great materials out there that made, straightforward guides of how do you do this. And that I think is at least partly because the people who did it didn't talk about it. So from a security perspective, when we talk about building secure systems, especially in like the cryptographic space, then there's a mindset that you should be able to fully describe the system that you have set up and and people should be able to attack it freely. Like, you should not rely upon security through obscurity. Therefore, I felt like if I can't tell everyone, at least generally, what I'm doing for my own privacy and security, then I'm relying upon security through obscurity. And that's more of a feel-good thing, because that means if somebody actually finds out what I'm doing, they're going to be able to find weaknesses and poke holes in it, and I'm not actually secure. So that's why I've tried to outline a lot of the steps that I've done. And really, in the couple of years since I started doing this, there have been better guides coming out. I usually point people to Michael Basil and his Ultimate Privacy Guide that actually volume 2 just came out on that. And it's a real page turner. It's like 550 pages now. It's about twice the size of volume 1. So it's good that there are people who are being more open about privacy. It helps us, you know, share knowledge and helps everyone who cares to, you know, improve their own stature. But like you said, it's a lot of trade-offs. It's not easy. It's not fun. We're creating barriers, obviously, for other people to figure out what we're doing. But in order to do that, you have to set up all kinds of proxies, whether it's network proxies or legal proxies or financial proxies. These things all, you know, I think of it as creating firewalls of a sort, but you're complicating your life. You are adding more moving pieces to your life that you have to manage. And that is the unfortunate trade-off is, you know, additional mental overhead of keeping track of these additional things.
Right, for sure. And your tools that you've been kind enough to share, you know, that's a great point. A lot of people don't share these things, but your tools are great. And those people who haven't seen your website, I think it's almost always listed. I see it as rightfully one of the top, more on the Bitcoin, you know, especially the Bitcoin resources, but you've got a really great site that you've obviously put a lot of thought and work into over, you know, many, many years. It's not the kind of site you just throw together. And there's many copycats, but yours is the source that I think a lot of others use for their source. So that's great. That's an interesting point about the obscurity, because I think there's a lot of people who kind of have their coins sort of safe, but there's another problem with the obscurity is that if they die, they probably don't even have an instruction list for their heirs. And if they do, it's, you know, I mean, the Da Vinci Code is a great movie, but you know, these things where people like, oh, I have three words written here and another one carved on my childhood sculpture. You know, those things are a problem. What are your thoughts on things like estate planning? And another related question to that is what about cases where you have to trust somebody, like a trust or, you know, law firms or investment advisors or something like that, where you sort of have to trust somebody? Do you envision those people ending up running the keys, or do you think there will be a place for third parties?
Yeah, this is tough too, because I mean, there are several people and entities that I've had to trust with sensitive information. You know, I have accountants and attorneys who essentially they know everything about me, and they could be a single point of failure with regard to my privacy. And so I do have to trust them with various things, though, of course, I'm not just handing my private keys over to them. That is thankfully a matter in which we have a bit more flexibility. So, you know, one of the things that we run into a lot, especially at Casa, the service that we're building, there is a trade-off between privacy and the ability to have people help you. So there are, you know, rightful arguments where with what we're doing at Casa, we try to make it as private as possible in the sense that we don't do AML KYC. We have ways for clients to come to us anonymously, and we have various anonymous authentication protocols that they can opt for. But at the end of the day, if they want to go to the level of having an estate plan that works within the legal system, their name is going to have to be somewhere on some document, and you know, some estate attorney is going to need to know how to execute the last will and testament. And so the ability for you to be secure and private in your holdings and your private keys is one mindset and set of issues that you have to worry about. But the other perspectives that I think the majority of Bitcoiners have not taken is, okay, I don't want the wrong people to be able to access my keys while I'm alive. The second half of that is, how do I make it so that the right people and not the wrong people can access my keys if I get hit by a truck, if something happens to me suddenly and I'm not able to, you know, transfer them to my heirs and beneficiaries. And this creates, of course, a much more complex security model that you have to think through of just protecting your keys against everyone but yourself is a straightforward thing. But when you get into estate planning, it can get really nasty if you get into a situation where, you know, the beneficiaries are key holders and they become adversarial, et cetera, et cetera. So basically, we built a whole protocol at Casa around this where you put your keys into a 3 of 6 setup where normal day-to-day operations, you have access to 4 of those different keys. And however, 3 of the keys are always kept in different situations where they can be accessed legally through the estate process with proof of death. So that could be a safety deposit box with the beneficiaries at either a bank or another private institution. One key, of course, with CASA, and then a 6th key with your estate attorney who will be, you know, conducting that entire process. And this type of setup, I think not many people have really thought through. You know, the people who have come to us and talked to us about their setups have done basically what you described and what we describe as the treasure hunt. And this is the same setup that I had for myself. And I set up a last will and testament a number of years ago, not because I had heirs that I was specifically worried about, but rather because I wanted to have something written down officially and legally of like, these are the crypto assets and this is how you execute them. And of course, the process that I came up with years ago was convoluted and never really got fully vetted. Like, I was never 100% confident that my executors would actually be able to pull it off and you find all the pieces of the keys and reconstitute them, etc. So it's I think a lot of it has to do just with putting in enough time and effort to create a robust model that can be reliably executed and that, you know, the people who are supposed to be part of that process understand the instructions. And, you know, we need to make these things as easy as possible because we cannot assume that your heirs or your executors are crypto nerds and they know how all these different technologies work.
Exactly. Yeah. Unfortunately, there's probably a lot of people that have lost a lot of money. You know, I'm sure you've heard of stories a lot of people that, you know, and it is scary because it is such weird and complex stuff, and it's always changing too. You know, something that might have been state of the art. I remember when paper wallets was the most state of the art. At least it was most state of the art thing I knew of. And yep. Then what was it, Glacier Protocol or something else? And then I suppose the people before paper wallets, they didn't even have that option. So.
Yeah, Glacier Protocol was, you know, the real gold standard. And in fact, the primary CASA employee that we had working on both our regular wealth security protocol and then our inheritance protocol, he was one of the co-authors of the Glacier Protocol. So, you know, very adversarially minded. But, you know, instead of us telling him, oh, create the ultimate security setup, we said, create the best security setup you can that is still, you know, executable by normal humans.
Right. Yeah, that's important. You know, the usability, because I think if it gets too hard, and I think we've all run into this, you things get it too hard, you end up cheating. You know, I mean, I got a Purism laptop and it was all complex and I made a password that was like this. Guess what I did? I ended up writing it down. It was so complex. And I'm like, well, wait a minute, that's bad OPSEC. We've got a million questions here. So let's see what we can ask. Hartej asks, I guess what your thoughts are on DeFi, WBTC, Bitcoin, and security.
Oh boy. Well, that's a whole,
that's a big one
conversation unto itself, right? You know, I'm watching DeFi, you know, from a sort of bemused, far away perspective of, I just see complexity. And whenever I see complexity, I see potential points of failure. I think it's fascinating because it's finance that can be innovated at a pace that is insanely fast compared to, you know, traditional highly regulated environments. And so that's why it's going to be really fun to watch. We're I think going to continue to see very interesting new devices, services, products, whatever. At least for the foreseeable future, I think a lot of these are going to be like highly speculative gambling type stuff that, you know, is going to blow up from time to time. People are going to get hurt. We're going to learn lessons. We're going to move forward. Hopefully, eventually, that results in some more stable products that are coming out of all of this. The like wrapped Bitcoin stuff, or like Bitcoin on Ethereum, Bitcoin on sidechains, etc. That becomes interesting from the standpoint of, well, what is happening to the actual underlying Bitcoin? And my understanding with wrapped Bitcoin is that it's basically in BitGo custody. I don't think that it's a federation. I think it's just BitGo custody, and that they then, you know, mint the wrapped Bitcoin on Ethereum and people can play around with that. And so you run into some interesting scenarios, for example, kind of related to, I think, what happened with USDC this week, where they basically blacklisted like $100,000. You know, what happens when some of that underlying money, that what if that underlying Bitcoin gets taken, you know, because the regulated custodian has some law enforcement action against them? You know, what happens to the rest of the wrapped Bitcoin from like a fungibility standpoint? Does it all become worth less because now it's, you know, 90% of backed? You know, can you enter into essentially a fractional reserve system because of some failure with the custodian? So like with Liquid, for example, that's a federation. I think a few weeks ago, there was some hubbub around potential security issues with how the federation was working and keeping all their stuff up to date. So, you know, it's complexity, right? There's more moving pieces. There's more things that can go wrong. But it's also enabling more innovation where, you know, people can go off on their own networks and do crazier things and experiment. So I'm continuing to watch it. But I gave a talk over a year ago where I basically, the title of the talk was DeFi for Defiance. And my main point was like, if whatever you're building isn't really censorship resistant, if it has points of failure or pressure points where law enforcement or other authorities can come in and essentially say no, then I'm not really sure that that is sufficiently decentralized to be decentralized finance.
Right. Decentralized finance without the D a lot of times. Zim Valancourt asks about OPSEC in everyday life. He's specifically wondering about AI and facial recognition, metadata. And I think, sort of in my own words, a question related to what he's asking is, what do you think about Americans combating actions like what you're seeing in communist China with social scoring? And, you know, I'm sure you've seen these video cameras, and they can identify you by your gait or by yep. just how you're walking down the street. And then they know, oh, okay, that's you. They have your credit report and, you know, all of this kind of stuff. What are your thoughts on that?
That is a really hard one. And of course it comes down to where you are physically and, you know, what your local government has instituted. On the bright side now, you know, you can walk around with a hat and glasses and a mask covering your face, and you generally won't get any weird looks. We don't know how long, of course, that is going to continue. You know, maybe that becomes a new normal, and people can rely on that. From really all the technology solutions I looked at of trying to defeat facial recognition are just, they potentially work at night, but not during the day. I'm not aware of anything that would really work against gait recognition unless you like put an insert in one of your shoes that made you hobble or something. But even then, I suspect there's probably ways for their algorithms to detect that type of thing. It's not an optimal solution, but really like the way that I look at it is most of the time when you're walking around and there's surveillance cameras, it's either because you're in like an urban environment where that local jurisdiction has set up a bunch of surveillance cameras, or because there's larger corporations. For example, I think it came out recently that it was like Lowe's or Home Depot, or maybe both of them, basically had cameras in all of their stores, and they were all networked and they were all getting fed into facial recognition software. And so whenever possible, and this actually works well for, pandemic status as well, but whenever possible, I just order things online because it means I don't have to physically go out and potentially, have various surveillance cameras pick me up. But of course, unless you're going to be a hermit and never leave your house again, that's not going to work for everything. I suppose, you can set up, or optimally, I would love to, just be out in the middle of nowhere. But I think even that is only a temporary escape. We already have, we have surveillance drones that got used during protests recently. We have satellite coverage of basically, every square meter of the earth. There's, I think, no perfect solution to hiding without essentially going underground into a bunker. So you have to figure out like what are the trade-offs you're really willing to make. What are you trying to protect yourself against? And I don't think that protecting yourself against like nation state level surveillance is really feasible.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we have an address that we stay at, and I try to keep our names off of that address. There's not really a need for it. And as simple as that is very, very hard. There's always something where they need your real name. They want to know where you are. There's legal documents. You may have a lease if it's a physical place. And then even if with where we usually stay, we have things sent. We don't even have them sent in our name, but all that does is basically obscure, the most obvious things. I mean, even Amazon can figure it out. They're not stupid. They're like, oh, okay, this person ordering a bunch of comic books and Andreas's book and everything, you were at one address and now you're at another address. They know it's us. They know the credit cards. I mean, and that's a pretty low level. I mean, forget about governments or something. I mean, pretty much with just a little bit of effort, I'm sure that a good private investigator could find almost anybody's physical location. And when you get into governments, I mean, people were wondering how the FBI caught, Epstein's associate. I say, how could they not? I mean, with the way that phones are and everything now, you'd have to make an extraordinary effort to avoid even a private investigator or Amazon, let alone a nation state.
Well, I mean, it's all about resources, right? Is you have to decide what is the level of resources that an attacker is willing to expend to find you. And the more you spend, the higher, you can make that requirement. If I recall correctly, I think the FBI said that they spent $5 million tracking down Ghislaine, which it's a lot, but for a nation state, it's not. I mean, if someone spent $5 million, I'm sure they could find me. But if they spent $5,000, $10,000, $20,000, they probably would not be able to find me. So, I think I have a reasonable idea of what would be required to find me. I mean, I pay private investigators to try to find me, but I don't pay them $100,000. So I'm not sure what level, that would result in.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. And it depends on your threat level, the threat model too. There's different, everybody has their own thing that they're worried about, whether it's, what your physical threats are, or what whether it's a mugger or whether it's a mafia member trying to hack your coins, there's different threat levels and different things that you have to protect against. So that's worth, taking into account as well. Let's see. Oh, here's a simple one. Maybe how about, how do you configure your home router? Any tips on that from Nathan Hawk?
Yeah, I recently wrote a article about configuring DDWRT and a VPN on that on a Linksys router. I actually prefer historically the high-level ASUS routers with the Merlin firmware, but the main point being that I think the lowest hanging fruit that a semi-technical person can do is to set up a VPN at the router level so that you're not having to configure every possible device on your network and having to make sure that they're all staying on the VPN. You know, you just set it up one time on your router and then have a kill switch so that it, you know, it kills your entire internet connection if the VPN goes down so that you know something is wrong. Other than that, I mean, you can get a little more complicated and set up things like a pie hole to, you know, intercept as many DNS requests as possible so that they're not going out to all these different advertising agencies that are then trying to, you know, correlate your activity across different sites. Other than that, there's not a whole lot that I do other than maybe some just sort of quality of service configuration. But, you know, I think the biggest problem that I've had with trying to go like full VPN all the time is that, you know, there is overhead for that. There's processing overhead. So even if I'm on a gigabit connection, I'm not going to get gigabit speeds anymore because it has to encrypt and decrypt all that traffic. And most routers are not particularly powerful. So if you really care about that, then you actually need to essentially have a full desktop computer that you run your router software on so that it can do all the VPN encryption, decryption. The one thing that I have not really gotten to play around with yet is WireGuard. Supposedly, you know, this is a newer VPN protocol that's supposed to be more efficient. That is on my to-do list. So, you know, hopefully I can set that up on my routers instead and get some better bandwidth.
Cool. Here's a good one. If the U.S., I'm going to vary the words a little bit. It says, when the U.S. bans Bitcoin ownerships and prosecutes devs, what would you do? I don't think you can prosecute devs, but they could ban ownership. What would you do?
Well, I think the most likely scenario, I would hope, if that were to happen, would be a sort of, you know, similar to gold repatriotization type of act, but rather Bitcoin repatriotization, where the government wants to take ownership of all the Bitcoin and use it as like a new reserve to back their worthless fiat. But one way or another, I think the question would be whether or not I would be able to escape to a citadel somewhere. You know, there's no time frame on this question. So if it was far enough in the future, you know, hopefully we'll have some like seasteads or other citadel fortresses that are in international waters or perhaps even, you know, newly formed microstates so that, you know, we have a safe haven to flee to. But of course, I'm not going to be able to hide from a nation state for very long. So it would have to be a fast decision.
Yeah, that would be a tough one. I mean, I think it's, although Carol Van Cleef, who's a leading attorney, she says devs more likely to be prosecuted than Bitcoin banned. I'm hoping the thing, because it's open source, at least with Bitcoin devs, I would go to bat to fight that, because I feel like all you're doing is giving software away. Other projects could be a different sort of story, especially if it's a securities offering or something like that. But with Bitcoin, man, if that was a thing, there's not a lot of things I'd want to go to court and fight the government for, but if that was one of them, I have no commits though. I've been looking for a spelling error on there so that I can get one, but I'm not a developer. I certainly can't code. So, and if somebody always catches the spelling error. So, but maybe they let me in so I could fight that in court, but, or better yet, let somebody else fight it. But hopefully the free speech issue, you have the right to write down code and release it. But it's interesting. So the next question was what you just referenced. What about Bitcoin Citadel? Should we start them? When can I join yours? That's from Gabe Higgins.
Yeah. I mean, we need to get started on this as soon as possible. Now, unfortunately, one of our client services guys actually at CASA is a former Navy, and I've had some lengthy discussions with him about seasteading and feasibility of, you know, having fortresses in international waters. And we're going to need much better defensive technology, essentially. So, you know, any things that's sitting out on the water in the middle of nowhere is a huge target. And when you're faced off against a nation state that has the ability to rain down hellfire from beyond the horizon, you can't even see them, then, you know, that's when you really need to have some crazy, you know, anti-missile technology. My only hope for how we might be able to combat that type of stuff in an actual feasible and I guess way that doesn't cost billions of dollars is perhaps through drone technology, or, you know, trying to think through, like, how do we use the aspect of cheap decentralized defense rather than extremely expensive centralized offense. So I am interested in drone technology from the sense of, like, mesh network style AI powered drone swarms, and, you know, what are the results of that? Like, how does that change the dynamics of war when you can have tiny little autonomous units that only cost a few dollars, and so it's possible, it's feasible for an individual or a small group to essentially create this new sort of collectivized defensive mesh net. But, you know, this is getting kind of far out there, but I mean, we've already seen proofs of concept of drone swarm technology. And of course, as all technology does, it's only going to become cheaper and more efficient and easier for people to play around with.
Whoops, I was muted. Somebody asked about Hive, Nathan Mars. I don't know if you know about Hive, but somebody, I guess it had a, I don't know much about it. I guess it had a hostile takeover by Steam. Do you have any suggestions about, do you know anything about this? Do you know anything about Hive or its governance or anything like that?
Only slightly in passing. I mean, it was kind of fascinating to see like a power play against a decentralized network. I think essentially, it was a power play against Steam to take over various, I forget, it was like miner hash powers or witness hash power or something. I think the witnesses were essentially staking on Steam. But I think the end result was the community just forked off, right? And so that's the great thing about open networks, is that, you know, even if there is a power play against one piece of the power structure, if the network as a general whole, if the community at large disagrees with a particular change, then all they have to do is find meat space consensus on what they actually want, turn that into code, and then deploy the code, and there you go. No one can stop that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating. There's been a lot of, you referenced it in a tweet a while ago. I know you mentioned like five different projects that have had security weaknesses, even though I think you said, even though it's open source doesn't mean it's secure. And that's a great point. The one I was most familiar with was Ravencoin, and that was always known. I mean, Fluffy and others warned about exactly that kind of the kind of risk, where being open source actually is a risk. And nobody has as many developers as Bitcoin. Bitcoin's right. Pretty secure because it has, I think, 750 people or something that have contributed, and there's hundreds and hundreds more. You have, you know, really high-end engineering capability at companies like Bitfury, even though they're not, you know, developers, they sure as heck know what they're doing and they're looking at the code, and nobody else has anything close to that. But even Bitcoin had a couple close calls over time. So I think a lot of people don't realize how complex it is. And I think you've talked a lot about it. A lot of folks like Adam Back and others have just continually drilled home this security point that I think a lot of people don't get because it is so different than the rest of the world.
It's very hard to quantify too. I think there's a general consensus that, you know, Bitcoin has the most eyes on it and therefore it's probably the most difficult to get malicious changes or even accidental bad code into the code base, but you know, it's still possible and there is no foolproof, you know, guaranteed way to prevent that. It's at least partially is just history. You know, the longer we can go without any issues, the more confident people will feel about it, but we should never be overconfident. We want to have as many people, as many different, you know, diverse views, perspectives, occupations, like of interested parties in the network, because the more angles of attack that, you know, people take on the network, the more robust it will be. It's, you know, one person might look at the code or might look at one aspect of the network and see one thing, and someone else might look at it differently and, you know, find a weakness that could be exploited.
Right, for sure. By the way, if I pause my video while you're talking, I'm still here. I'm just doing that for bandwidth. The Last Coin Standing asks about progress on Lightning Network, gaps in where it is and where it needs to be. What are your thoughts on when we can get there? And do you have any concerns about risks or impediments to Lightning realizing its vision?
I mean, there has been a lot learned about Lightning Network over the past couple of years. We've seen even just over the past month or two, you know, new research reports coming out showing various weaknesses that developers need to think more carefully about when they're trying to figure out how to move forward with designing the network. My own personal experience has, you know, led me to find a number of different edge cases. You know, there are a lot of things that can go wrong because once again, this is extremely complex. You know, we take the base Bitcoin protocol and then we build a whole other protocol on top of it that is also based upon a lot of game theory. And so what happens is we've created a whole new game and now we have to go through a fairly long process of various people playing that game and figuring out what are the actual rules to the game, because we don't necessarily know them. We know what we think they are, but there's always unwritten rules. You have to keep fleshing those out until we have a network where the rules that we think are in place are the actual rules that are in place. So it has been, I think, slower going than a lot of people hoped for, but it is also gone, I think, better than expected in some sense, in that I fully expected that by now we would have seen some, you know, catastrophic collapses of the network because of one edge case or another. And while there have been, you know, a few issues where, you know, we needed to do like some emergency updates because there were potentially catastrophic problems with like channels, for example, and the values that people thought were on them, this has not actually led to, you know, massive like adversarial loss of funds or massive sweeping channel closures, collapse of the actual network graph. So I think that the developers have done pretty good job of, you know, staying conservative in their changes, and we're making incremental progress. And while that may seem like it's going slowly, eventually, you know, years from now, we'll look back and say, oh, look at all the progress that we've made. But there's definitely still, from my perspective, mostly robustness issues at the individual level that need to keep being improved, because there's still plenty of ways you can lose money on Lightning. And I've spent a decent amount of time helping people recover money from nodes that have crashed or had other issues. And, you know, it's still a fairly complex technical thing to get in under the hood there. So I think for us to get to the point where it really is just a mainstream push button, self-custody type of Lightning setup is going to require some more robustness, especially around like light watchtowers, for example. It's the inane issues of like data management and keeping backups of data, which it becomes, I think, one of the challenges that we have to deal with whenever we're talking about private key management, is that everybody likes to talk about adversaries that are trying to hack you and take your money. And that's an obvious thing to talk about. The less sexy aspect of all of this, which I end up spending probably more of my time dealing with and thinking through, is the user. You know, how can the user screw up or suffer from some random catastrophe that just causes them to lose money? It's not that someone stole it. It's just that, you know, we had a hard drive die and now your data is gone and you didn't have backups. You know, it's more boring stuff like that that we need to figure out how to make that bulletproof before I think we're really going to see mainstream adoption of this.
Yeah, I agree. And it's always those last mile little things that end up wrecking people. Not always, but a lot of times, you know, I know in the stunt business, they say that the most dangerous thing is usually the more simple stunts. You know, when you have something really, really complex, when Vin Diesel's doing a skydive off a building, they put a lot of safety into that. There's this footage going around of Tom Cruise. He's hanging out. He actually hung outside of a plane for a shot. But those aren't typically when the people die. It's when they're, you know, they're doing something they've done 100 times. Speaking of complexity on top of the Bitcoin, Bitcoin and second layer stuff, do you follow some of the projects that either do side chains or, you know, other things looking at tokens on top of Bitcoin? So you've got RSK, RBG, Liquid. Do you have a favorite? Is that a space that interests you?
I'm also kind of watching from afar. I have not directly actually used any of those technologies. So I don't have an opinion or comment directly, I think, on like one of them being better than the other. You know, they're each taking their own approach. Mm-hmm. And that actually, I think that's, you know, that's better to have that, you know, diversity of different approaches to things. It seems like Liquid gets the most press or the most folks talking about it, but this could just be due to my own bias of, you know, who I'm listening to. RSK is definitely interesting because they're, you know, merging Bitcoin with Ethereum virtual machine, though I can't think of any projects off the top of my head that are well known that are using it, but that could also just be my own ignorance. And RGB, I think, is probably the newest and least mature of all of those. So definitely still waiting to see some folks like building stuff that I can play with on top of it.
Yeah, I think it's exciting, and I'm psyched that I like them all. Just want to see everybody doing all, and I'm hoping that there's enough of them that you know, they're slightly different. Some of them are a little bit more of a cypherpunk versus centralization trade-off. I hope there's going to be uses for all of these. You know, you may have an activist group has a need for some sort of token that allows them to communicate, and meanwhile, a regulated security in the United States has a token that they've got to, you know, comply with AML rules. You know, totally different use cases, and hopefully different, you know, either side chains or entirely other chains. So that comes up on, well, let's do one more question on our sort of 45 minutes here. And thank you again. This is a good one to close on. Michael Gerton asked, can you give an example about the most recent time you changed your mind about something significant related to Bitcoin, and what made you contribute to that change in thought?
Ooh, most recent change. I mean, I've had a number of different changes in opinion. I mean, my largest change in opinion throughout my entire time in Bitcoin was definitely around block size stuff, though that has been several years now. You know, essentially before I went full time in Bitcoin, I was like, oh yeah, you just make the blocks bigger. It's obvious. But it wasn't until after I was running a bunch of Bitcoin infrastructure and seeing what the effects of that would be and how difficult it already was to build like indexing services, for example, that grabbed all the data and sliced and diced them, and how those were like steadily taking more and more resources, that I changed my mind on all of that. I've slightly changed perspective over the past year. You know, as Casa, we started off with our multi-sig self-custody product, and then we came out with the Bitcoin and Lightning node product as well. And, you know, we were hoping to start building out, you know, a comprehensive suite of, be your own bank type products, essentially. And one of the things that we realized, you know, after we saw the success of the node, it actually arguably gave us like more press with the node product than with the self-custody product. But we actually determined that there was very little overlap between those two things. Like, we essentially ended up with like two different market segments of customers, where the people who were interested in the node, and this of course is making blanket generic statements, so there's plenty of people that don't fall into this, but in general, the people who were interested in the node were sufficiently technically sophisticated that they had the ability and the desire to also do their own key management and not have like a really user-friendly guided experience. Whereas the folks who either didn't have the time or didn't have the technical sophistication to set up their own self-custody were not at all interested in the node, despite the, you know, ideological aspects of running a node. And so, that was one of the reasons we ended up cutting the node product line for the foreseeable future. We can always bring it back, but it's going to be, I think, a challenge. And the main reason for that, it actually comes back to what I was talking about before, of the boring IT data management stuff. And like, we knew that shipping a node in a box product would present additional challenges, because you're essentially putting hardware out into unknown environments that are going to have all kinds of crazy variables. And we saw a lot of unexpected things. But when you're asking someone to essentially start managing their own server, you know, even if you're building as much automation and, you know, recovery logic into that hardware as possible, then you're still going to have to deal with electricity outage, you know, issues, with networking issues. And these are the type of things that I'm not sure that we're going to see a simple solution to until other aspects of just like the internet and networking in general get improved upon. And I definitely want us to get there eventually, but I think that we know it's more important for people to have their own keys than it is for them to necessarily be able to validate, you know, everything that's happening on the blockchain. Like, you know, I think Trace Mayer used the like first class, second class, third class citizen type of thing. I kind of see it as different tiers, you know, of being a self-sovereign Bitcoiner. And the managing your own keys and validating all the transactions and doing it all in a sovereign way where you're not relying upon any third parties that are single points of failures. You know, this is the ultimate dream of Bitcoin, and it has always been achievable. Like, the promise of being your own self-sovereign bank has always been there. The question is, what can we build that lowers the bar for people to achieve that? And so at the moment, you know, at Casa, we are focused on getting people to the private key management level of, you know, being able to have a robust setup that they don't have to spend a lot of time worrying about. And hopefully once we get enough people into that level, we'll be in a position where we can start to think more about that final level. How do we have a fully packaged, like all-in-one solution that is, point that, people can be their own fully encapsulated system, their own bank setup, without having to deal with all of the boring ins and outs of private key management and server management and data backups and redundancy and all these other little things. So like, I see the light at the end of the tunnel, but unfortunately, I think it's further away than I hoped, or I would have said a couple of years ago.
Yeah. What's the old saying? We underestimate what we can do in 10 years and overestimate what we can do in 1 year. So that's Bitcoin for you, right? Well, thank you again. We really appreciate it. It's wonderful to have you you join us. This will be rebroadcast. We'll be able to rebroadcast it on YouTube, and we really appreciate you joining us. And hope to see you in person again. And I hope you're safe at your tent in Guatemala. Sorry. thank you again, Jameson. You have a great time. I hope you're safe, and we really appreciate it.
Thanks. See you.
All right, have a good one.